This is a Defocus Media production.
And now a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 77% of eyeglass wearers wipe their lenses with t-shirts, tissues, or towels? Or that 1 in 3 people actually admit to accidentally dropping their glasses at least once a week? No one in the eye care industry needs to be told that this will lead to scratches on lenses and unhappy patients. So it's hardly surprising that 93% of wearers consider scratch resistance an important characteristic when choosing lenses. The latest Crizal lens innovation is here to help, and it's more durable than ever before. New Crizal Rock lenses are 3 times more scratch resistant than entry-level Crizal products and 2 times easier to clean than main competitors after extensive smudging. For more information about how you can bring this incredible new technology to your practice, go to EssilorPro.com/Crizal-Rock or contact your Essilor account executive for more details. Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Welcome back, everybody. I am delighted to have as a guest today in the first of this series, Dr. Jim Williamson, an optometrist at the Memphis VA Medical Center, who in times past was one of the people that I sought out personally when I had a patient back in the years when he was at a referral center where I really had no idea what to do with. And he would take charge, jump in and dive in and really offer a lot of support to both me and the patient. And we're going to be talking in the next episodes about a deep dive into imaging that we employ as eye care providers. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Well, yeah, those were the days.
Would you walk us through, before we even get started into this, you know, what get everybody up to speed on your professional career and you know, where you've been, where you've gone, and where you are now?
Yeah, so I finished my residency, which is one of the best decisions I think I've made in my career. It opened up a lot of doors for me that I didn't realize at the time was going to happen. I got into education right off the bat. And back then in education, it didn't pay necessarily great. So sort of changed modalities and went to the referral center and worked with an ophthalmologist for close to 3 years and gathered some great experience. That I wouldn't trade for anything. And then the call to teaching sort of came back. The job at the VA Memphis here came available to be residency supervisor. And I thought I would jump back on board. And it's been fantastic ever since. Actually, this December 2 will be my 19th year. So looking forward to number 20. And SCO has been great to me to take me on as a adjunct faculty, a consulting member. It's been wonderful being able to be there as well. So I couldn't ask for anything more.
So what a lot of people, especially younger optometrists and those considering this profession may not realize is a lot of the content, if not all the content that we're going to be talking about, really has not been around for that long. You know, there was a time when we had to practice without any of it. And so, you know, for the last X years, we've been trying to fine tune our ability to use these instruments at their fullest capabilities. Whereas before that, we didn't have any of it. So it's interesting to really reflect back on seeing patients without these imaging techniques. And now fast forward today, where we have a lot more ability to see the patient and their eyes at a much deeper level.
It's amazing. And I don't know, sometimes I yearn, like I said earlier, for those old days. You certainly can treat and diagnose the patient better nowadays, don't get me wrong. But back in the day, you're right. Well, you had your eyes and then you had a fundus camera and maybe you had a B scan and a fluorescein angiogram, but other than that, your imaging was limited. You didn't have these multiple imaging modalities, the multimodal catchword that we have today.
Yeah, I think you and I are on the same page, and we're gonna probably wrap up the entirety of these episodes with a discussion about technology is great, but sometimes they can handicap the provider in a way that feels like a crutch versus relying on your own intuition, your own instinct, and your own eyes. And so we will definitely get to that debate, but let's start with OCT. OCT stands for optical coherence tomography. Jim, walk us through that. How do you recall it came to fruition, and what are the types, and what exactly is this thing doing for us?
Well, you know, when you research into OCT, OCT's been around for a long time, actually. It was developed back in the early 90s, but we didn't really see it until at least the early to mid 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, commercially, when our first device came out. And that was what they call a time domain device, where basically you had a couple of different reference mirrors, and you know, you bounced a sound off that, or a wavelength off that mirror, and it reflected back off the retina. And depending on the difference in time between the reference mirror and your reflection mirror, you'll be able to tell the depth of something. And it was not a bad image. The quality was decent, but nowadays, you know, your quality is much better. We've got spectral domain, which is wavelength oriented, which can give you anywhere between, you know, 5, 4, 3 micron resolution. Swept source, which is a longer wavelength, gets you down a little bit farther, a little bit faster scanning speeds. And so we're looking at things that we've never been able to see before.
So what's the most, so you mentioned retina. Is that the most common part of the eye that we're using this for?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So kind of backtrack just a little bit. There's a new device actually that's coming out on the market, and it's getting ready to get FDA approved. And I was looking it up on the website the other day, and they actually had a picture of a meibomian glands, an IR picture of meibomian glands. And those of us, I started out with the Spectralis. That's sort of back in 08 when that first came out, the second version of it came out. That's just what I know. And we've been doing it since then just because it's an IR camera. So we know what it is. But some of these companies now are starting to get on board and saying, you know, hey, we can apply this to other different things other than retina, and market ourselves and tell our practitioners, hey, this is just the only thing that this is can be used for. We can use it for other things.
I love what you just said. And so I'm going to plant a seed for our audience members to be on the lookout for a future podcast when this technology comes to market. Because Jim, I'll tell you a funny story. It has nothing to do with our topic tonight. But back in, I don't know, approximately 2015, my wife and I were lecturing in Australia, and one of the lectures I was delivering had a reporter there who was gonna like take notes and then publish a report on the topic. And I was talking about ocular surface disease and my meibomian gland dysfunction. And I said aloud that I don't know about anybody else, but it has appeared to me through my biography as if I've seen glands that have either were once truncated and then started to resolve, or once completely absent and all of a sudden regenerated. So I don't know exactly what's going on, but I'm seeing this with my eyes through these scans. And I can't tell you how many emails I received over the last 5 to 6 years from people all across the world who read this report saying, oh my God, I suffer from this condition. How can I get done to my eyes what you're seeing in your patients? And honestly, quite frankly, I question our current method of doing meibomography. I'm not sure that's really scanning glands. I know it's scanning something, but I don't think it's really scanning a gland. And so it could be what I'm seeing is not real life. And I'm waiting for the day where OCT technology can look at meibomian glands in their full depth. And I think at that point, by the methodology you just mentioned, to really look at true depth of anatomy, that I'll really get a feel for what's going on with patients with, you know, really complex anterior seg disease.
That's a great point. And you know, you if you like I said earlier, when you research OCT, OCT is being used in many other professions, and that and skin and dermatology is one of those. So yeah, to your point, that's a great concept for that to happen. I wish they would spend just a little bit more time doing that. You know, you have the anterior segment attachment on these devices that allow you to do the cornea. You know, why can't you flip down the lid and you know the conjunctiva is clear. So why can't you do something like that and get down to those meibomian glands and get some more qualitative data than what you're getting just with an image through the IR camera?
No doubt. So let's dive more posterior seg now, the back half of the eye. We have OCT where this technology, at least in our eye realm, started to focus, no pun intended, on retina issues, optic nerve issues. When you started employing this in practice, what were the most common types of scans you were using it for? Was it more retina, was it optic nerve, or was it split?
Yeah, probably split, but I remember most of all doing those early RNFL scans where the patient was sort of moving their eyes and you just all of a sudden captured this scan around the optic nerve. It probably wasn't centered right. And then you got this, sine wave curve and you were looking at it and you were sort of not knowing so much about how to interpret it because it was such a new technology. And then you were looking at the retina and some of your patients that maybe have had cataract surgery, you were looking for some cystoid edema and trying to see if there were some changes there in the retina. So probably a little bit of both on that aspect, but it was so new. You're almost looking at the scan in awe that you were actually seeing this. And so times have definitely changed as far as your interpretation skills of the technology.
I would say from my personal experience looking at OCT scans across providers and manufacturers, the one thing that stands out to me for a retinal scan that illuminates in real time my view of a patient's eye that I did not have before it was appreciating that there are layers to the retina. In anatomy class, in microanatomy, you learn the layers of the retina, but in a physical observation of the retina, you really see a two-dimensional plane unless there's reasons to see something in three dimensions, which is usually an anomaly. But with OCT technology and bisecting the retina, being able to truly visualize what's going on at each of these layers really started, at least for me, to connect the anatomy to the physiology and the pathophysiology of a condition.
In fact, we were talking about this today in clinic. So two examples of that, when you see diabetic retinopathy, the old term, dot blot hemorrhages, well, that's not really accurate. That's what they look like. But now we know with OCT that those were just intraretinal hemorrhages. So we're more inclined to change that terminology. Same thing with macular holes. When Gass came out with his staging of macular holes, it was a very detailed staging. And the term pseudo hole really is just a clinical term where you would say, this looks to me clinically like a hole, so I'm going to call it a pseudo hole because I don't know for sure. And now with OCT, we can actually call it something. We can say, yes, this is a lamellar hole, or per the VMT study, vitreomacular traction study, we can call it, yeah, this is a large, small, full thickness or whatever macular hole. So things have changed. You're right. You can actually see the anatomy. You can see those layers. And it's important for all of us to know what those layers are. When we're looking at the retina, now you need to know all of them. You need to know where you're looking at. So yeah, great point, Chris.
So it's 2021. The episode, one of the last episodes that we posted was about an established practitioner out a number of years who is embarking on opening a new practice. So one of the things that she's going through is how much of a loan does she need to take out, and to what extent? You have the build out, you have the rent, you have your staff. And optometry and ophthalmology really have to invest in ophthalmic equipment, which comes at a price. So the first question is, well, what do I need? And based on our topic of imaging, what do I need an OCT to start practicing optometry?
Yes. Now, having said that, it sort of does depend on your practice modality. Let's say that if now in your scenario, a person opened up the practice, yes, you definitely need one. Now, do you need a brand new device with all the bells and whistles? No, I don't believe you do. You need something where you can, you know, look at glaucoma. You need to look at some retina, but you don't need to go out and, you know, get the top of the line devices that are out there. And, you know, case in point, you know, I work at the VA, so I don't have to worry about that build out deal, which is nice. But we have our original Spectralis from 2009 that still works great. And we upgraded to another machine, actually to two different machines we got. And so we're looking to get rid of that. And they were going to offer us $7,000 on a trade-in. Well, that machine works great. And it's got quality images and does everything that I would need it to do in that sort of situation. So I would encourage somebody to say, hey, let's go outside the box a little bit and not look at maybe a brand new unit, but catch one that's, you know, we all know this technology is changing so fast. And if you're just starting out, you know, you don't need to plow down, you know, $178,000 for top of the line, everything you need OCT. You can get something more on the cheap and does exactly what you need.
So if I'm in a practice that's really seeing minimal disease, I'm more of a refractive practice, how would I employ this versus if I was doing, you know, full scope medical optometry, how might I employ this? Or is it pretty much going to be the same across the board?
Well, you know, if you're refractive, I think from what I read, and of course, I don't know because I'm at the VA course, but from what I read, a lot of the people will do these wellness exams when they get these instruments where they just carte blanche, you know, scan every patient that comes through. And for me personally, as we talked about before, I think that you need to look at the patient first before you do any of those scans. You know, you should drive the machine's use versus letting the machine drive you. You know, if you're in a routine practice that does mostly refractive, you know, you may not get that use out of it that you need. And of course, if you're have astute clinical acumen and you're dilating these patients and you're being able to notice these pathologies and you're mostly refractive, then obviously you can get those to the right folks that you need to do. So, yes, sort of six in one, half dozen in the other, I guess.
All right, so the last thing I want to touch on in this episode, you led me to, and that is, you know, akin to the technology of automobiles where they're soon to be driving us, if not already there. How do we navigate having the OCT drive us to decision-making and diagnosis versus us navigating and driving the instrument to what we want to have answered?
Work on clinical skills first and foremost. So, you know, you read these stories about, you know, they do these ads that come out and you read, I've seen things I've never seen before now that I'm doing all these wellness scans. Well, there's two ways to look at that. You know, are you a good practitioner? I know it sounds kind of blunt, but are you actually doing a good job doing a fundus exam on your patient versus, you know, a neurologist isn't going to do an MRI on every single patient that comes into to see them. And right. they're not going to do an MRI before they actually physically see them. So you translate that or took that into the optometric role. You're going to want to look at the patient first before you do that scan. On the other side of it, you know, you driving the machine is that you need to learn how to drive. You need to learn how to interpret that machine. And I think that's the big thing I see most of all is misinterpretation of these scans. And honestly, that could be a whole podcast by itself. You know, the mistakes that are made interpreting these scans, whether it be segmentation errors or the different nuances that go on and looking at these things. That's a big thing that I see.
So how does somebody learn? In other words, so I bought a new instrument. Or I bought a older instrument and I'm employing it and I know how to use it at its most basic capability, but how do I master it?
Read the manual. Isn't that funny? But it's so true. I mean, a lot of times we just don't read the manual. I learned things. I was just reading on our Spectralis platform. We just got the ability to do OCTA and I was reading the manual and the manual mentioned something about how if a patient has greater than 3/4 a dot or a cylinder that maybe you should do the OCTA with their glasses on. What in the world? You know, I've never done that in all the years, but it says it in the manual. So I think reading the manual is very important. You know, look up things in the literature. There's a lot of stuff that's out there on interpreting OCTs. You know, I think in preparing for this, one of the articles I just love is, and I was really excited. I was on a podcast or on a webinar, and this person actually came on board. It's a must read, and it's from John Chen and Randy Carden. And Carden is out of Iowa, like a lot of the big names in ophthalmology are. And they wrote an article, I think it was around mid-2015, somewhere around there, avoiding clinical misinterpretation and artifacts of optical coherence tomography. And it really had a lot of good points about what you can do to make sure you're not misinterpreting those things. And the biggest thing is, you know, looking at green disease, where you just basically are looking at the street light, the red, yellow, and green. That's probably one of the biggest mistakes that I see is, you know, patient can be tanking on you on RNFL, but they're still in the green. And so you just look at that color and say, oh, they're great, you know, no problems. Whereas, you know, you look at the specific quadrant or clock hour and they're losing, you know, nerve fiber layer by the minute, and we're not catching it because we're just looking at the color. It's a complicated thing, but it's something that takes effort, and you got to want to make that effort for the best of your patients to make sure that you're interpreting that data correctly.
I love it. Yeah, we are definitely going to talk about red, yellow, green disease some more. Thank you, Jim, for joining us in this first episode of A Deep Dive in OCT, and I really look forward to talking again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.